Welcome back to The Pursuit Zone. I'm Paul Schmid, and I interview explorers from around the globe to bring you their exciting stories. These are people that dream big, break out of their comfort zones, and take on ambitious pursuits. This is episode 201 with Karma and Scott. It's a story about selling their stuff and setting out on a long trek from Norway to New Zealand. Let's get into the show, and let me introduce my guests. Karma is from Sweden and Scott from New Zealand. They have a passion for long-distance hiking and exploring the world. Not wanting to be owned by their stuff, they sold everything but the packs on their backs, and in 2019 began a multi-year trek from North Cape at the top of Norway toward Bluff at the bottom of New Zealand. So far, their journey has taken them through 8 countries. They traveled through the UK during winter, then into France and Spain, where the adventure was paused in March 2020. You can learn more about them and their adventures at rebootlife.me. Karma and Scott, welcome to The Pursuit Zone.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
How did you guys meet?
We met when I was in New Zealand back in 2017. I had just finished the Tiaroa long distance trail that spans the whole country of New Zealand.
Yeah, and Karma was reaching out online about a short visit in Wellington before she was flying home, and we just got started chatting, and
Yeah, we just hit it off, and I was just going home 3 days later, so we knew that we kind of wanted to continue having a contact, so I invited Scott to come to Sweden for a visit, and we wanted to go hiking that summer.
Yeah, and I was pretty excited about that. I'm a mountaineer. And I wasn't going to pass up an opportunity to go to Sweden and walk through the mountains with...
Yeah, with me. Yeah, so 6 weeks later, Scott came to Sweden and we had planned like an epic mission up in the far north of Sweden. There's a really cool national park, Sarek National Park. It's past the Arctic Circles. It's really far up north and it's kind of the last wilderness of Europe. It's not no trails and no real infrastructure, and it's really wild and it's really epic. So I figured if I was going to invite a mountaineer to Sweden, I needed to show him the best we got. So that's kind of what we did. So we were out in my little solo tent for 3 weeks, more or less our first date. So that was kind of like the baptism of fire. You know, we really hit it off.
Yeah, and as you, things just don't work out the way it's planned. So we were planning some epic sort of ridge walking and mountaineering type style, but it ended up just being really bad weather. So we were just walking in these big, wet, rainy valleys, sleeping in a single person tent.
Yeah. Well, we did get up and do some really cool ridges, but not quite the mountaineering adventure that we had planned. But we learned something about each other that we could actually, that we enjoyed spending time under hardship, sort of out with minimal resources. And we had a really good time. So that was setting us up for things to come, I suppose.
Sure.
Yeah, obviously, if you're enjoying the 3 weeks out in the rain in the single person tent, for sure, that says some things. You guys have, I think, also beyond your mountaineering experience, Scott, you guys also have some long distance hiking experience. What you're doing now isn't your first long distance experience. What have you done before?
Yeah, that was kind of my thing. I did Kungsleden, the King's Trail in Sweden, back in 2016 with a friend. And I really, really enjoyed like staying out for a really long time, doing the long trail from end to end. So when I finished with that, I jumped straight over to New Zealand to do the Tiaroa trail solo, like a couple of months later. And that was about 4.5 months out on trail. And when I came home from that, I jumped straight over to Scotland to walk the Isle of Skye with a friend. So I really got the long distance bug at that point. So my plan all along had been to do the Pacific Crest Trail next. And since Scott and I had, started a long distance relationship at that point, we decided to do that one together. So we were the class of 2018 on PCT. So that was really cool. That was your first real through hike, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I found it quite exciting. You know, I was more of an adrenaline junkie type guy, mountaineering, ice axes, crampons, rock climbing. So the thought of going on a really long hike didn't really interest me so much until we started talking more about it and Karma explained it to me, you know, this long distance hiking for long periods of time. And I just thought, you know, the challenge of just being out for such a long period of time, like the logistics of it and the ongoing hardships that are going to eventuate because of weather and terrain, just excited me enough that I wanted to really take it on board. So it was cool. And we also did the Green Ribbon.
Yeah, Gröna Bandet in Swedish.
Yeah, the Green Ribbon Trail in Sweden, well, Scandinavia, and the Arctic Trail is another long-distance trail in Norway while we were on our longer expedition. So, yeah, it's been cool.
Yeah, we have planned to do a lot more, like, long-distance through hikes along the way on the expedition that we started last year. So we'll see what happens with that going forward. But we really enjoyed, like, the long-distance through hiking experience. So that's kind of been our new thing together to do.
I don't know much about the Isle of Skye. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's the Skye Trail is what I did. It's kind of an unofficial route that covers the whole island in Scotland. I went top to bottom. And it's just a really cool, it's not super long. It's 128 kilometers, I think. So I was out for like 5 days. And you just, you know, walking across the island, it's really, really beautiful. But I had always dreamed of Scotland because you see all these amazing photos with the cliffs shearing off into the ocean and the, you know, the green, emerald green, you know, lush landscape. And it's stunning. And it's just, you realize when once you're there that that one day out of the year when Scotland looks like that, you're lucky if you're like nailing that, because the weather out there is pretty epic. I had rain pretty much the whole week I was there, and you know, glimpses of those amazing sceneries. But once I hit like the most iconic place with the really, really cool mountain structures, Old Men's Store it's called, then it was completely white out fog, and I filmed some of it and sent it to Scott, and he was just laughing, you know, because we knew what it was supposed to look like, but I didn't see much of it, but it was still very cool.
It didn't look that pleasant.
No, yeah. But Scotland is really cool. People there are amazing, super friendly. So
let's talk about this walking the world that you're doing. It's, I think everybody, including myself, has this desire to like quit their job or whatever and go off on some epic adventure. And maybe, you know, everybody's idea of what they do is a little different because maybe not everybody wants to, you know, sleep in a tent every night. But you guys, before you got started on this, you had to go through a little bit of a process to downsize your stuff, kind of basically sell everything in order to take on this big multi-year adventure. Tell me a little bit about the process that you went through of getting rid of all your stuff.
Yeah, well, I was living in my van in New Zealand and sort of working, and, you know, material possessions weren't a big part of my life, especially not when me and Karma met at that point. When we did start selling stuff, it was more about making room so you could come up with that epic adventure. You know, these things started becoming holding us back, you know.
Yeah, it was a little bit different for me. I was a bit of a crossroads in life, I suppose, where I wanted to simplify my life. I had been on an extended sabbatical from work for a few years. I was an art director in advertising, and I had a really bad burnout. So I've been walking for more or less than 3 years or so when I met Scott, and I hadn't really missed any of my stuff, like the stuff I had in storage and with my parents at home. So I just felt it was time to get rid of it all and get free from it all. So while I had a lot more than Scott did when we decided to go on this adventure, I had an apartment, a car, and a bunch of furniture and just stuff. You know, it wasn't an emotional difficulty for me to part with it all. I was ready to get rid of it, to be honest. And it happened really fast. We didn't make the decision to go walking, and 6 weeks later, we had a clean slate. Everything was gone, and we were on our way. So it was a really cool experience for me.
How logistically challenging was it to get rid of that stuff in such a short time frame?
I think we just got really lucky.
Yes. We literally sold the car the day we were jumping on the train up north. So we handed over the keys like 2 hours before we jumped on the train. So we were really, really lucky. And that became kind of a big part of our nest egg that we were planning on living on for the next 5+ years walking across the world. So it, the motivation to get rid of it all was really strong.
We're really good at like sort of actioning ideas and problem solving along the way. So any roadblock we sort of hit around that stuff, we could sort of move through it quite comfortably. And that's one of the joys of being with Karma, is we can do that together.
Yeah, it's really cool to find someone who is just as spontaneous and just as excited as I feel like I am myself. Like when we decide to do something, we just jump in both feet and just go for it. Like whatever problems we encounter along the way, we just tackle it when we get there. And we're pretty similar in that sense. And that's a really refreshing and freeing experience.
You guys, within a 6-week time, you made this decision, you got rid of all the stuff. And then is this also during this time frame that you have to do whatever planning you need to do? Any route planning and get all your gear together?
Yeah.
Luckily, we had most of the gear already since we've been out on long hikes for the past few years. So that wasn't too much of an issue. And we kind of knew what we had to pull together the logistics in that sense. But yeah, the far north of Scandinavia is probably the trickiest section logistically, just because it's so remote in sections. So we actually did have a plan ahead quite a bit when it came to doing some food drops. We sent a few boxes up to mountain stations along the way up north, just simply because it's so far to get to anywhere where you can resupply. And so that was a bit, but Scott did most of that.
Yeah, it's like when you're on an expedition of this magnitude, you got to put everything in blocks. So like when you've got a 6-week period, you know, I just focused on Scandinavia. That's a block of time that was manageable to sort out as fast as possible. And when you're walking it, it takes months to achieve that. So like you can organize everything else going forward while you're on trail. You know, especially walking into easier countries to manage, like Germany and Netherlands and the UK, you know, it's a lot more simple. So, you know, it worked out.
Yeah, that's kind of one thing you learn after you've done a few long trails. Like, you can never plan for the whole thing, start to finish, in detail. You create like a rough plan of kind of when and where you want to be according to seasons and stuff. But that's, you have to be flexible along the way. So you learn that you can only really plan the detailed stuff a week or two out in advance. So that's kind of how we approach this expedition too, even though it's going to be a multi-year event. We just kind of take it as you go, because if you're not flexible and you're rigid in your planning, a lot of the joy is taken away, because you're not going to achieve what you expect to achieve along the way.
Certainly, I think having the 2018 PCT experience really helped you, you know, dial in everything, and pretty much you guys should be ready to go.
Yeah, that was an experience in itself, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, the PCT is a very unique trail in the sense that it's so well established, and the trail culture and the support around the trail is really amazing. So that was a really cool experience. What we did after that, like doing this walking the world adventure, was completely different, because we were on trails for the first part, but then after that we were just making our own route. So you're not part of like that amazing culture on trail and that support network. So that was new.
Yeah, and the PCT was sort of a test for me as well, since I was coming back from a mountaineering injury. So my ankle, I actually had to get it unfused or rebroken, how it healed. Walking the PCT loosened it up and gave me the ability to be able to, you know, look forward to doing longer hikes, because I was in kind of pain for, I don't know, what is it?
The first month or so, at least.
Yeah, I think the first 500 miles or something.
Yeah.
It was pretty painful for me to walk the PCT, but eventually it sort of healed itself into working order again. So
that's one thing that's really cool about hiking or walking. It's, you know, fairly low impact. And I had really struggled with my knees from an earlier injury in the 90s. And I just realized that walking actually strengthened my body slowly. And I told Scott that, don't worry, hiking will heal you and walking will heal you. And it actually did. So you came back from that injury stronger from hiking, I think.
Scott, when you had that ankle rebroken, is that, I'm just curious, does that require like a full anesthesia or like, how does that, what kind of a surgery is that?
It wasn't a surgery. It was like, because my ankle, I was struggling at work before we left. And I was like, there's no way that I'm going to be able to walk this far because I didn't have a proper walking stride. So one foot, the ankle would roll onto its toes and the other foot couldn't do that. So it would be like this weird flat footed sort of step forward. So I went to an osteopath and she said, look, it's just a lot of ligament damage and it's lost the ability to point your toe up. So she said, we can do a forced break or a forced movement to see if we can loosen it up. And that's what she did, a little French lady. And it hurt. But then I had to do a whole heap of exercises in the weeks following, like on a ball and rolling my ankle and just pretty much walking as I would usual, regardless of the pain. And
yeah, I think it was busy. It had fused together awkwardly. So you just had to grind off that, you know, cartilage or bone or whatever it was that was fused wrong. And eventually when it became smooth, the pain went away.
Yeah.
Sort of. That was my unscientific assessment of the situation.
Yeah, there was no right way to do it. You just had to walk through the pain, and to be able to do that, they needed to get the movement happening again. So that's what they achieved.
Yeah,
no anesthesia, no surgery.
Like, how are you guys navigating and planning your route, and what technology are you using? Because I saw on your website you have a photo of your gear layout, and I see you had a couple of iPhones. Is that your only technology?
Yeah, we figured out, you know, walking this long distance through so many countries, paper maps wasn't really feasible. You know, to acquire them and to carry them will be a logistical nightmare in and of itself. So we have an iPhone each, and we decided to use Gaia GPS as our navigation platform. And it worked really well. So by having two phones, we had a backup if one should fail.
Yeah, it seemed to work really good. It's just the price of getting maps or printing out maps for such a long distance didn't really make too much sense anymore. Like, the technology has come such a long way, you know, you need to use it to your advantage. And we had a power bank, so the phones weren't going to run dead. And we were using using a solar panel to charge up that power bank. And obviously, any time we ran into a power plug, we were using that too, and we didn't have any issues, did we?
No, it worked really well.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the first section of the let's talk about walking through like Norway, Finland, and Sweden. And I know that at some point you got injured, Karma. So we'll talk about that, but we'll put that in the parking lot for a moment. But take me up into the point where you got injured.
Yeah, we started at the North Cape. That's the very top of Norway, literally where Scandinavia ends. That was like, you know, pretty remote up there. So the first month or so, I think we saw five people out on trail in total. So out in that area, you don't have cell phone connections or anything. So we carry a PLB, a simple locator beacon, basically, not one of those you need a subscription or a two-way communication device. We walked about a month or so before I got injured, and it was just one of those sections of trail where we had probably underestimated the amount of calories we needed to complete it. So we were running really low on calories, and we were a bit tired. We were pushing long days, and towards the end of the day there, I just took a stumble on trail and hit my knee. And
yeah, we're not talking about the accident now, are we?
Ah.
Well, we can. We're already here. So I was reading through your blog, and I read about that you cut your leg and that you needed to be airlifted out. My first thought was, why? can't you just like put a little Band-Aid on it and keep walking? And then I saw the photograph of the injury and I was like, oh my gosh, that's a pretty serious injury. So what happens after the point where you guys decide to activate the personal locator beacon? How long does it take for the helicopter to get there?
Yeah, it took about 2 hours. So it was really quick for them, you know, because we were considering it could take longer due to weather at that point in time when it happened. It was very low cloud cover and it was slight drizzle and it looked like there was a storm front sort of about to head in that evening. So we were a bit concerned whether they were going to get in the air and would be willing to fly over top of the mountains to come and get to us. But the military guys, they actually came through the valleys, so they flew underneath the weather. So they got to us in 2 hours, and that's pretty quick.
Yeah, so it was the Norwegian Army that came to pick us up. The mountain rescue up in the far north there is really, really good, especially Norway have a huge helicopter fleet. And we kind of felt like we were stuck in the middle of a Top Gun movie or something, two really young pilots having a grand old time flying through this, you know, dodgy weather. And
yeah, it was cool.
It was really cool. But I was lucky, you know, it was just a simple fall. It should have been a grazed knee, you know, a little scratch with a Band-Aid, like you said. But for some reason, my knee, I hit a rock and it must have been really sharp and it split up like 12 centimeter gash all the way into the bone. So we definitely knew that I couldn't walk out on that knee. So we were brought back to civilization and they stitched up my knee and we went home to my parents for 3 weeks waiting for the stitches to come out. And the minute the stitches came out, we were really itching to get back on trail. So I was lucky. I didn't hurt anything really, really badly. No ligaments or anything was hurt. It was just a big flesh wound and needed to heal. So 3 weeks after the injury, we were back up on trail walking again.
Did that situation make you think about the type of first aid kit that you carry at all?
We always have been carrying a fairly decent first aid kit. And we were commended by the doctors on how we took care of that injury, just basically dressed it with sterile bandages and wrapped it up real good within minutes of the fall. So some people carry very light kits. We carry what you need to actually handle a fairly decent accident on trail. I'd carry that PLB for 3 years and never had to use it, obviously. And this was one of those times where you're like, yeah, it's a good device to carry. And I wouldn't want to be out that remotely without some sort of communication device if accidents should happen, because we were not doing any high risk kind of activity at the time. We were just hiking and on a fairly good, decent trail and accidents happen. So.
The good things about that accident was where we were in a position where the helicopter could land. We were really visible. We weren't underneath any bush line or on the side of, mountainside or anything like that. So we were in like the perfect situation to assess what had happened and just take the right actions and not have all these other things that usually, you know, stop you from dealing with someone's injury really quickly. You know, in the mountains in New Zealand, you know, your first task is usually to make them and you and safe, depending where you are when the accident happened. But this one, we were just on flat ground, weren't we?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was such a clean injury, so we didn't even need to clean the wound. It wasn't dirty or anything, so it was just a simple wrap and wait situation. Yeah. We were really lucky.
What did you like most about hiking through Sweden and Norway?
The remoteness, you know, at the very top of Norway, it's a different world again. Like we're looking out over the ocean at the top of Scandinavia, and it was so windy. It was amazing, barren landscape, and we turned around and started walking, and you're just walking. It was like a desert landscape, wasn't it?
It's like a tundra up there. It's really windswept and barren, and
yeah, and to slowly walk your way out of that into like small beach forests that were very wet and it was full of mosquitoes and sandflies at that time, and you make your way through that sort of terrain, and then you start dropping down into these large sort of canyon valleys with beautiful rivers. And then eventually suddenly you're walking into the mountains that you can see from the distance and you're like, we're going to hit the Norwegian mountain soon, and the snow capped, and then you get in there, and it was just an incredible experience. It was like a journey walking from barren nothingness into these intense large mountains that were just, they sort of swallowed you up. It was beautiful.
Yeah, we followed the Scandinavian mountain range all the way from the top all the way to the bottom, basically. So for a couple of months, we were up in the mountains, and it was really, really amazing. And this was summer 2019. So the cool thing that far north is you have the midnight sun. So basically, the sun never set. We were, I remember Scott pointing out, you woke up 3 a.m. to go to the toilet, I think, and you just said, the sun is still up, you know, this feels like daylight. Yeah.
Birds are chirping and stuff at like 3 a.m. You got to really convince your mind to just go back to sleep because, it's highly confusing.
Yeah. It's beautiful. And you have really long hiking days. You can walk as long as you want to. So that's a really cool part of it. And also, like the dramatic landscape, the U-shaped trough valleys from shaped by the ice age to really beautiful glaciers up on the mountain passes. And
it feels old, doesn't it? Like, you know that stuff was carved out of this huge, movement of ice, and you can feel it. And when you're walking through there, that this happened a long time ago, because a lot of other times you're mountain ranges and you know that they're like, they were built from earthquake and stuff like that, and they're still eroding. So you don't get that same sense. But this stuff is settled, and it's here to stay. And you can sort of, that a lot of stuff has happened in that area before you walk through there.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's an energy thing, man.
Yeah. So we were kind of straddling Sweden, Norway, Finland for the first couple of months on trail there.
Did you guys have an opportunity to stay at any of the huts along the way, or did you mostly stay in the tent?
Yeah, we are in a pretty tight budget. So there's an amazing hut system in both Norway and Sweden, but they cost quite a bit of money, actually. So we stopped into quite a few huts to check them out because they're really fascinating. Some of them are really old. So we would stop in to just have a peek or have lunch, but most of the time we stayed in a tent.
Yeah, we paid for a couple because of the weather just got to that point where you would just head off. You would know where a hut is, so you would head there and you'd spend time there. And a lot of the time there was other people there. So we would end up at huts with other groups of hikers, and it was great to socialize because you're isolated with each other in these remote places a lot of the time. So it's a cool place if you get lonely, I suppose, up in that sort of place. You can head to one of the huts and you're most likely going to find someone up there. Yeah, we couldn't have afforded to use the hut system all the way through. It's unachievable for us. But
yeah, if you're out just up for a few weeks, it's a great system because you can get out of the weather and you get to meet people and a little bit more comfort. So it's really cool. And but for us, since we had such a long mission ahead of us, we had to be good with our money.
Yeah, and the hut systems right through Scandinavia are different. So in Finland, they're free, and then there's another side of a hut where you can pay to sort of upgrade a little bit.
Yeah.
In Norway, it's a key system. So you need to apply to get a key, and then you need to, it's like an honesty payment system. So then you mark down in the book that you were there, and then you pay when you're finished using them. And then Sweden, do you remember how those ones work?
Sweden, the huts are more or less, there's a volunteer host that stays in the huts during the primary hiking season. So they will greet you and they will handle like payment and stuff like that.
Yeah. So Sweden are actually got manned huts. So that's a different experience again.
Yeah.
So you're sort of well looked after.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of prices are we talking about here? Like 10 euros a night, 20 euros a night or more?
There are discounts for members of the tourist association. So if you're a Scandinavian citizen, you get a discount on the huts. So my price would probably be about 15 euros a night, and Scott was almost double. So
mine was like 30 euros for one night.
Yeah.
In a Norwegian hut.
And roughly the same in Sweden, a little less expensive.
Yeah, that's a big chunk of your budget there. That's a lot.
Yeah, and we love our tent. So we're really more comfortable in our tent anyways. Nobody's snoring or, so it's
I must say that these aren't really like huts. They're more like lodges, in a sense.
Yeah, well, the hut system in New Zealand is very rough compared to the Scandinavian hut system. Yeah, they're pretty high comfort. There's usually propane gas available, and there's mattresses and, you know, even like bedding sort of that you can use. So it's a whole different comfort.
Yeah, they're really comfortable huts.
More like a hostel.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
After you guys get out of, you make your way out of Sweden, I guess, and then into Denmark, where things change a little bit because now you can't wild camp anymore. What was it like through Denmark and then through Germany with no wild camping?
We didn't actually end up going to Denmark due to Karma's accident. I think we lost roughly about 3 weeks,
yeah.
Close to a month. So by the time we got down to where we needed to make a decision to either ferry over to Denmark, we decided to go to Germany because we needed to make that time up mostly due to my visa restrictions.
Yeah, we had to leave Scandinavia.
Our
visa in Scandinavia had run out.
So we wouldn't have made it through Denmark in time before my visa ran out. We ended up catching the ferry to go over to Germany instead.
Yeah, we walked to the very south of Sweden to Malmö and took the ferry over to Travemünde in Germany.
Germany is one of those places where I think it would be really cool to make a route through Germany where you could, like, every few days or maybe even every day hit a small town. If you could hit a hostel, stay there for a low price, and then just keep on moving, traveling lightly. I think that'd be a really cool adventure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Germany's an interesting place too. Like, that was our first experience of sort of these. It's a different architecture, isn't it? It's hard to explain.
Yeah, the cool thing is, like, the countries in Europe are very close together, but you notice a dramatic difference just crossing that invisible border. And Germany is very organized, very, like, strong, heavily handed architecture.
Brick and square and large, and, you know, everything seems clean and tidy and everything has its place. And
yeah,
it was an interesting country to walk through. But
yeah, but that was, you brought up the wild camping aspect. That was the biggest change for us, really, because in Norway and Sweden, wild camping is available and free and allowed. So we had been really spoiled coming through Scandinavia in that sense. We can camp up pretty much anywhere. And Germany, wild camping is not allowed and it's not really done, I would say. But that was our plan all along, to wild camp through the world. So you just have to learn to amp up your stealth game, basically, choosing a spot where you're not going to be seen or you're not going to bother people. And
yeah, and like the route that we took, we weren't reaching towns every day or anything like that. So you're forced into a situation where you sort of need to wild camp. And I think no one was really bothered as long as you were continually moving.
Yeah.
Like, we've got asked sometimes, like, why are you camping? We're like, we told them we're on this expedition and, you know, and we're going to be out of here tomorrow. And they're like, oh, okay, that's great. You know, as long as you're continually moving, no one was really bothered. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, we were always very respectful to where we are and make sure we leave no trace and all that stuff. But we're usually in late and out early, so we're not really in a place long enough for people to notice that we're even there. So the wild camping aspect wasn't too difficult.
I have it in my notes here that you had some trail angel experience in Germany. How are you finding these trail angels?
They find us.
Yeah, they reached out on Facebook, didn't they?
Yeah.
On our Facebook group, they reached out and said, hey, we're in Hamburg, and if you're passing through, you can just come and stay with us. And we were like, we were a bit standoffish about it, really. But then we were like, why not take in some hospitality? And
yeah, well, that was, you know, before you get used to that kind of generosity, we're very independent. So we were like, oh, we can't ask to put people in, indisposed people, you know, asking for showers and laundry and a bed. You know, that felt a little bit, we were a bit unused to asking for that kind of help in the beginning. But we met some wonderful people who has been very generous opening their homes to us. And we just realized that they were bringing something into their life as well. So it's a give and take scenario. And we were very grateful to the people who invited us to stay.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah.
When you're in Germany, are you still plotting your own route, or are you on more of an established route already?
We were sort of piecing together routes to get us as quickly as possible, because winter was catching up with us, wasn't it? It was like following behind us, so it was getting colder and colder. So you want to, the colder it gets, the faster you want to move. So we ended up using well-established cycle and walking trails through Germany that led us through all the apple orchards, led us out to the coast that was pretty barren, actually. But it was sort of, it was nice to see the water. And
Yeah, we were heading towards the Netherlands. So we were just basically plotting the fastest route as we could to get there.
Yeah, so on a day-to-day basis, it was changing.
Yeah.
But that was sort of exciting as well. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and all of a sudden you get to some place and you realize, we can't really get through here because there's no way to physically walk from one end to the other because there's freeways, highways, and you have to make detours around that kind of infrastructure.
But if you research where you are, you'll find that there's trails, walking trails, cycling trails, and things like that. And it was difficult for me because a lot of it's in German. And so you're finding these websites, but I was finding it really difficult to find out information. But on our Gaia map system that we were using, there was an outdoor overlay, and you could use that, and it could show you on the map established walking and cycling trails. So that was a huge tool for us going forward.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden you see a trail marker where you're walking, and you could Google that, and you can get a little bit more information. And that was a more low-key approach to route finding as well.
Is it from the Netherlands that you get over to the UK?
We kept pretty much at the top half of the Netherlands. We walked through Amsterdam, but then we walked in Rotterdam towards the Hook of Holland. That's where we were aiming to take the ferry over to the UK.
As your journey's going on here, you guys are beginning to have some questions about your gear. I think at one point you've noticed some issues with your tent. And so you're thinking maybe our gear isn't up for either the winter or the long haul of this journey. So you decide to make some changes in your equipment. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I think the biggest change was the tent, and it was starting to wear out, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the tent that we had on the PCT. So it's already done a lot of miles at that point. And it was a 3-season tent. So we knew that that was probably going to have to be upgraded at some point. And we really like Hilleberg tents. That's the tent I've been using on all my walks. And we reached out to them and we just talked about some of the concerns we had with our existing tent. And they were amazing. They were really cool. They really thought that we had a cool journey ahead of us. So they upgraded our tent to a 4-season tent, basically as a trade-in. So we more or less just got a tent upgrade on trail for a very reasonable sum of money.
Yeah, we had to send our old tent into them because they look at them and they can see how it was used and where the wear and tear. So they can use it to base their
research
and how they make their tents in the future. So it was a pretty easy trade-off.
Yeah, we just paid the difference between the two tents basically and got a brand new tent. It was amazing. And we really enjoyed that 4-season tent. It made a huge difference as far as the winter weather and stuff.
Yeah, like the payoff of carrying something heavier is for us paid off in dividends because it's your shelter. Like it rained a lot on our trip.
Yes.
And you want to be able to climb into something, feel really secure in there with whatever weather's hitting you. We called it the bomb shelter.
Yeah.
Because it was just life-saving and you could get warm in there and get changed and you could feel safe and there was never going to be any leaks or issues. And just to have that peace of mind, regardless of weather, was huge, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we talked to people along the way and they were talking about this was one of the wettest fall seasons in memory. So there's a lot of rain happening, but we were kind of lucky in the sense that most of the rain happened at night. So having a good shelter was paramount for us to have a good experience, basically.
What other gear did we upgrade?
We only really upgraded our sleeping bags, and that was another, those bags were kind of summer or 3-season bags, and we knew that we were going to need something warmer for winter. So we did that already in Sweden. We upgraded to winter sleeping bags.
Yeah. Like when we started the expedition, we just took our old gear and we knew we were going to wear it out by the time we sort of ended the Scandinavian section. And so, yeah, it was nice to get better sleeping bags because I was starting to get cold at night.
Yeah.
And
but other than that, it's not much that we replace. We carry, you know, gear for all seasons since we're going to be out for so long. You can't really have the logistical thing of sending yourself gear on the way. It's not as simple when you're doing this type of expedition compared to a through hike, for example.
Yeah. So we had a full system to cover all sort of terrains and weather and stuff at any one time.
Yeah.
It was, and it worked well.
What was it like being in the UK during winter?
Wet and muddy.
The mud.
Yeah.
It was just phenomenal. And the amount of water that was just sitting around. There's not much drainage, is there?
No.
Like whole roads would flood and paddocks would flood and there's just, you couldn't escape it. There was no safe place. So we sort of just had to get into this rhythm of saying, we're going to get wet feet today. It's going to be really muddy. And we got used to it, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah. People were saying that it was unseasonably wet. There's a lot of rain. But just the way that the UK road system, they have the roads are lined by hedgerows instead of drainage ditches. So that infrastructure was kind of missing. And with extra water, extra rain, it was just, yeah.
It just became huge water catchment.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, yeah, don't go hiking in the UK in winter.
No, it was still beautiful, but like we were walking along the Jurassic coast, you know, on the southern part of England, and it was really, really, really beautiful. But I can imagine doing it in summer and being a lot more enjoyable just because.
Be amazing.
Yeah, not having to contend with the mud.
Yeah, because it's muddy, it's slippery.
Yeah.
And it's
slow going.
Yeah. And you've got to be really cautious of where you're stepping. And sometimes you're just walking yourself into parts of trail that you just don't want to be there. And you just look at each other and you're like, we should have just walked the road because this is horrendous, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, but all in all, beautiful coastline.
Yes.
Eventually, you guys must need to kind of take some breaks or something and kind of recharge, because I would think that the way that you're living your life out in the elements and in a tent every night would begin to wear on you. What have you decided that your kind of your rhythm is for? We can handle being out hiking for this amount of time, then we need to like get inside for a certain amount of time to recharge, to clean up, and so on. How does that work for you guys?
It sort of doesn't. Now, we had some established places where we decided we were going to have some longer breaks to do what you say, like recharge. So there was in Brighton in the UK, that was one of the places, obviously, where Karma's parents and family live in Sweden, in Gothenburg. And then we stayed with your sister for a little bit further down in Halmstad. And so we had these established places. But they were very far apart,
yeah,
weren't they? So it was like we had maybe a week break every 3 months. Would it work out about that?
Yeah.
It would work out about that. There was these huge blocks of time where we were just, you know, sort of charging on ahead.
We're a bit stubborn that way. We don't like to sit still. So we just kind of push on until you hit the breaking point and then you realize, oh, maybe we need to take a break. And then we do. But a lot of those breaks happened with us just taking a day off in the tent, mainly because we have a limited budget. But
yeah, we like to keep moving.
Yeah.
We like to keep moving. Yeah. But you're right. Like you do eventually burn out. You do eventually need a place to process what you've just done. Like,
yeah.
You know, and sit back and appreciate the journey. And we're really bad at doing that.
Yeah.
So that's a big learning experience going forward, is like, how do we make these little blocks of time so we can look back on what we're achieving and be proud and sort of and look at it and, you know, and enjoy it.
Yeah, because that's, you touched on the processing factor, that when you're moving constantly for a really long time, you don't have time to really process what you're experiencing. So you're just moving ahead. And now when we've stopped and we look back on the last like 8-9 months, we realize what we actually have achieved. But while you're in the middle of it, you don't really have time to catch up mentally or emotionally.
Yeah, your perspective of the whole thing is completely different, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've had the experience doing the PCT and you've had experience in hiking in Europe. I get a sense, because I'm an American and I can see a lot of things on YouTube about hiking on all these U.S. trails, but I don't really have a sense of what's going on in Europe and in the long-distance hiking community. My sense is that it's kind of a big thing here, the long-distance trails in the U.S., but is through hiking a big thing over in Europe?
I don't know if through hiking so much is as big as in the U.S., but the hiking culture is really strong, and there's lots and lots of trails. The hiking culture in Norway is amazing. The hiking culture in the Alps, for example, is really, really amazing. But there are some established long-distance trails in Europe. The most famous one is probably the French Camino in Spain, the one we were heading towards doing. But there's a huge network of trails that you can do. And a lot more people are trying to explore the through hiking aspect of doing the longer trails as well, but it's not as established as in the US.
And the thing I noticed is the long distance trails in Europe are, you couldn't just come and get a backpack together and go and do a long distance trail in Europe, like say the Via Alpina over the Alps. Mm. You would need a lot of experience to do that. They're more suited in America, aren't they? They're maintained better. That's what I noticed. As soon as we started walking the PCT, I was like, wow, this is like a really well-trodden, established trail. It was very clean. There was hardly any overgrowth. It was you were dropping down into towns regularly. The whole long-distance trail system in the U.S. is completely manageable. You could just go and walk it, like, and you're not going to hit too many speed bumps, are you?
No, and the trail culture around the trail, the support network from trail angels and just support along the trail is very, very established in the U.S. So people know what you're doing. If you're hitchhiking, they know, that's a PCT hiker needed to get to town. I can pick them up. In Europe, you're not going to be as inclined to be picked up perhaps by hitchhiking because they don't really know what you're doing there. So it's not the same support around the trails.
Yeah, and the maintenance on the trails is completely different as well, you know. Yeah, they're not as clean and as well maintained.
Yeah.
What was the experience in France like? You were on the French Camino and you crossed over the Pyrenees into Spain. What was that like going through the Pyrenees?
We actually walked over the Pyrenees at night.
Yeah.
Because we had a weather window we were trying to get to, and that closed on us as we arrived, and we would have had to wait 3 or 4 days for the weather to pass before we could go over there, unless we walked over that night. So that's what we did, and
yeah.
It was beautiful. It was clear skies. It was walking in moonlight, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, basically we're very early in the season, so this is kind of before the hiking season truly starts. So we knew that we could encounter weather up in the mountains, and that's why we pushed on that night walk. But the French Camino, it's the first day or two it goes over the Pyrenees, but then it drops down to lower altitude after that. So that was quite pleasant and cool, but nice hiking temperature.
Yeah, and they have a summer route and a winter route, and the time that we went over, we were only allowed to walk the winter route.
Oh, the summer route. The high route was closed, so we had to walk the lower route.
Yeah, the winter route. So, like, they force you onto the road for a lot of it, so you're not actually allowed on some of the big ridge walks due to the dangers, because obviously they've had incidences there in the past where they've had to rescue people because of weather change up there. So, yeah, but it was nice.
Do you guys ever have to walk through tunnels? And if you do, what happens in that in those situations?
Oh, yeah.
There was one tunnel that goes under the water in the top of Norway.
Yeah, there was like 7 or 8 kilometer long tunnel under the water from one island to the next in the very far north of Norway. And we just decided that we wouldn't be able to walk through it safely with the air quality and the time it would take us to walk through the tunnel. So we hitchhiked through that tunnel.
No other choice in that aspect there. But when we came across other tunnels, we ended up walking over the mountain. There's usually a trail that leads you up and over. So we did that one. There was a one-way tunnel that we ended up taking an old road over the over the top of the hill. And when you're route planning, you just sort of make sure that you're not going to end up in that situation. But when you do, there's usually an alternative.
Yeah. We really walk everywhere. It was funny because people would stop now and again asking if we need a ride somewhere. We're like, no, we're fine. You know, we walk everywhere. And they're looking at you when it's raining like sideways and it's really cold. And they're like, really? And we're like, yes. Because that was the objective. We didn't really look for the easy way. We were out walking. So that was...
Some of the bridges felt a little bit unsafe because we're forced right onto the barrier side. And when there's large trucks driving past and stuff, it can get a little bit hairy, especially if it's raining and things like that. But you sort of just try and get over them as fast as possible, don't you?
Yeah.
Along your journey, are you seeing a lot of wildlife?
Not a lot, I wouldn't say, but we saw some really cool ones up in far north of Scandinavia. We saw moose, deer, lots and lots of reindeer.
Yeah. Eagle, the golden eagle. What else? You saw an Arctic fox.
Yeah, those are really cool. And then we saw footprints from Wolverine, but we didn't see the actual animals. That would have been really cool to see.
Yeah, and there's a snake up in Europe that we saw, and that was sort of cool.
Yeah, the common European viper.
Mostly it was just repetitive, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like lots of deer and...
little bunnies and stuff, nothing spectacular. Oh, we saw some huge river rats in France. They were like small dogs. They were huge.
They were ginormous.
Yeah. Oh, one night in France, I woke up and I could swear something was trying to dig up from underneath me under the tent. So I'm pretty convinced there was a mole under our tent trying to come up underneath my sleeping mat.
Yeah, lots of moles, but you never see them, but Karma felt one.
Yeah.
I'm curious now because you guys are kind of out there. I'm not sure how much you're paying attention to the outside world. So in this current deal that we're in, the world's beginning to shut down all around you. Are you guys aware of this, that this is happening as you're hiking, or does it come as a surprise to you?
We were completely aware.
Like, yeah.
And we were daily monitoring what was happening.
Yeah, we have our phones, and in Europe, the connection is really good. So once we left the far north of Scandinavia, we never really were out of mobile coverage.
Yeah, we had reception every day. We could just – it was interesting because in France, we weren't concerned at all. And because everything seemed to be happening in Italy, it wasn't until we crossed over into Spain that we started considering – what we were going to do.
Yeah, it was really bizarre because we crossed over into Spain and there was like 170 registered cases of coronavirus in Spain at that time. And just in a matter of a week or not even 2 weeks, that number had jumped to like 4,000 or 5,000 cases. So it was like that exponential growth was happening really, really fast. And we were feeling pretty uneasy about it because we were walking through one of the three main hotspots in Spain at the time, the La Rioja wine region of Spain.
Yeah, so we were actually like pretty much walking through one of the major areas except for Madrid. It was Madrid and then where we were walking that were really major hotspots.
Yeah, so we were monitoring pretty closely, and we actually, 3 days before we decided to postpone or like put our expedition on hold and actually leave Spain, we had bought bus tickets to leave 3 days before that because we felt like, oh, this is getting pretty gnarly. And we were concerned about getting stuck in Spain because we were thinking that they might shut the country down. But we didn't want to overreact, did we? So we're like, no, let's continue. So we threw away those bus tickets and kept going for another 3 days.
It was interesting because we were in a cafe. We said, let's stop, have some lunch, have a coffee and regroup and make a decision. Because at that point in time, you could really tell that something big was coming. And in that cafe, we decided that this is the time we're going to postpone the trip. And as we were leaving the cafe, the restaurant, the people said, Spain has now called an emergency and everything's shutting. So as we made the decision, the whole country
started shutting down. Yeah, the WHO declared a pandemic happening in Spain, a national emergency, and we literally caught the last bus from that town to a larger town where we could actually rent a car.
Since we're in these small villages, you can't really make any large decisions of like trying to get to airports and stuff. So you got to go directly to the biggest town where you've got options. Like, you know, we ended up renting a car, and, you know, because public transport was sort of a no-go at that point in time. And we decided, instead of going to Madrid with the state of the airport in Madrid at that time, was to drive where we were all the way to Barcelona. We thought we had a better chance. And the Barcelona airport was absolutely packed, and they actually cancelled our flight. It was like everybody was warring to get out of Spain because the next day they were going to shut the borders.
Yeah.
And everybody knew that, like they had announced it pretty much, yeah, that, you know, you need to get out of Spain now. So
they cancelled our flight, and then we booked another one real quick online, and that was overbooked, so we were on standby, and we just decided, this is going to be bad. So we basically didn't check in our backpacks. We used them as carry-ons and just walked from counter to counter asking the airlines, do you have extra seats? Do you have extra seats? And finally, we got booked on a plane to Germany, and we made it out of Barcelona literally by the skin of our teeth. We were very lucky to get out of there.
If you had anything more than carry on, you wouldn't have been able to have that option.
No. Yeah. And we are still at that point. We were kind of optimistic. We thought, okay, let's fly to Sweden. Let's regroup and see what our options are. We were a little bit in denial that we were not going to be able to continue our expedition in some way or form. So we flew to Sweden, and pretty much we stayed for a couple of days. We went into self-isolation, so I couldn't really see my family or friends or anything. And we just realized that this is bad. The world is literally starting to shut down. And we were concerned that Scott is not allowed to stay in Sweden for an extended, you could stay for a couple of weeks, and then your visa options will be pretty much gone there.
Yeah, and I didn't have much faith in Sweden extending my visa and stuff because of the amount of time that I'd spent there earlier on with the expedition and stuff. And there were still flights to New Zealand at that point. So we made the decision we should attempt to try and get on one of those last going flights to New Zealand.
Yeah, I have a lot more visa options here at the moment. So that's been one thing that's been kind of hanging over our relationship from the beginning, and one reason why we have been traveling pretty much nonstop for the 3 years since we met. It's this, you know, I'm from Sweden, Scott's from New Zealand, and in order for us to be together, one of us more or less has to immigrate. Otherwise, our options are very limited. We can stay for a few months on visas, tourist visas here and there, but if we wanted to be together, we made the decision that we needed to travel. So we've been doing that. And that has been the one thing that's been dictating what we can and cannot do from the beginning. And it's still hanging over us now.
Yeah, so that's sort of why we're here. So we've got more visa options. And obviously I'm back home and I haven't been here for like 2 years. So it's really nice. And
yeah, we were lucky. We were on the second to last plane out of Gothenburg, Sweden on Qatar Airways before they stopped that route. And we made it to New Zealand. They closed the borders in New Zealand for foreign nationals when we were in the air. So our planes were one of the few last ones to land where I could have actually come into the country without trouble, basically.
Yeah, you snuck in.
Yeah, pretty much.
The skin of your teeth.
Yeah. And then we went into self-isolation for 14 days. And during our self-isolation, New Zealand decided to go under lockdown. So we've actually been on lockdown for, 5 weeks now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll end soon. And I wanted to ask, a couple of questions around this. One is, because you guys are on a pretty tight budget, this is, I'm sure, has impacted your budget more than you want it to. Are you able to take any opportunity in any way to earn some money or use this break in New Zealand to try and build some funds back up?
Not right now, not at the moment, since everyone's in lockdown. But obviously, when the restrictions lessen, I can go back to work.
Yeah.
And so that will help. But it was a bit of a financial
hit
getting all those flights because they weren't cheap. But the reality is that you just need to get out of these countries, you know. Otherwise, you're just going to be stuck there. So it wasn't that hard a decision, was it?
No, we definitely feel like there was decisions we had to make at the time, and we're glad that we made them. But yeah, it did take a big chunk out of our budget. But, you know, we had budgeted to be on traveling for 5 years, so we had the funds available, thank goodness. So we're okay. You know, we always approach roadblocks or like changes in our plans rather matter of fact. Like, the situation has changed now, and we're just going to roll with it and see how the future pans out.
Yeah, and like money just comes and goes. You just spend it and then you just go make some more. It's just that's sort of what life is. So you can't get hung up too much on the financial side of life. Otherwise, you just won't enjoy it.
Yeah, you know? Money is just a means to do cool stuff, but it's not like the end of the world if you lose it all. So
yeah, you just make some more.
Yeah.
Has being in the lockdown situation, has it strengthened your desire to go out and start up your adventure again, or has it weakened it?
I think it brought us back to reality a little bit. And if you look at it as from a global perspective of what's going on, we don't have that much faith that we're going to be able to just go and restart our expedition and be able to just happily walk through the world.
Not for the next year or two, or perhaps even longer. You know, it's...
Yeah.
Even after there is a vaccine, there's the whole socioeconomic impact of the aftermath of the coronavirus across the world. So, like I said, we're pretty easygoing and flexible. We've accepted the situation. It's changed, and we're looking at our options for moving on with our lives pretty much. But the expedition, as it was, doesn't feel feasible to just kind of pick that one up anytime soon. So we'll see what we're going to do next.
Hmm.
What are one or two books that you guys would recommend that people read?
Oh, man, I didn't even – I ignored this question when when you sent us the email with some of the questions, and this question came up. There was just – it was like some of the books that I read I wouldn't recommend.
Why is that?
Well, because I like interesting – like, you know, I'm into – but I was talking, what about George Orwell, like 1984? I really liked that book because of when it was written in the 1930s, and it was this guy with this perspective of how the world's going to look in the future, and it's just a really interesting book that I enjoyed reading. And then other books that I like to read are sort of, I don't know, they're really boyish. like the lone warrior out surviving in the world, you know. It's just
Personally, I haven't had time to sit down and like settle into a book for a really long time, so I don't know, I couldn't really think of something that I wanted to recommend in that sense, because I have changed and life has changed so much since I really really read a book that impacted me a lot. So I would just say, like, watch Cowspiracy, The Sustainability Secret on Netflix. That's like a crowdfunded documentary exploring like the impact of animal agriculture on the environment. That was a documentary that really made me think a few years ago when I saw that for the first time, and that was a cool.
Oh, that made an impact on your life, didn't it?
Yeah, and like,
yeah. There was a book I read, the Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now, like years ago, maybe like 10 years ago, and I remember that was a big deal for me back then because it taught me how to, you know, become in the present moment. But since then, there's been this huge movement around, you know, like
mindfulness
and meditation and stuff. So I don't know how relevant that book is now, but I really enjoyed it at the time I read it. Mm. And it did help, and I did take on some of the practices and continue to use them in my life today. So, yeah, I can recommend that one.
Cowspiracy, the 1984 by Orwell, and The Power of Now.
Yeah.
There you go. I read a huge book once called Shantaram, and it's like 1,000 pages or something. And it was a true story about this Australian guy. He escapes out of prison. He makes it to New Zealand. He ends up forging a passport to get himself to India. And he's like, he was this bad guy. And then he starts working for the Mumbai mafia. He ends up falling in love with this lady. And then he finds a spiritual awakening. And then he goes back to Australia and hands himself in and does the rest of his jail time. And I found that a really cool book. True story.
I think I have that in my Kindle waiting to read. Wasn't there recently a sequel to that book that got published?
I have no idea.
You'll have to check into it. I think there was. Where are your interests going to take you next, do you think?
Well, something that we talked a lot about while we were out walking was that at some point, whenever we got to New Zealand at the end of this big adventure, we talked about building a little tiny house on some homestead somewhere, an off-grid little tiny house, and building a permaculture garden and growing vegetables.
Yeah, it was like this ongoing, like, daily conversation we were having as we were walking. We were talking about these future sort of dreams, what our life is going to look like at the end of this expedition. And, yeah, and it was in New Zealand, and it was building an off-grid little house and stuff like that. So we're going to move forward on that now, I think.
Kind of moving the schedule up a little bit on that dream instead of, you know, like waiting for that to happen at the end. But at the same time, we also don't feel quite ready to settle down and put down roots any particular place. So we're going to kind of continue along the lines of how we lived together before. Scott's lived in small vans for most of your adult life, and we built a couple of vans together before, but now we've actually bought an old bus that we're going to convert to a tiny off-grid home on wheels. So
like a school bus or like a just regular passenger bus?
Yeah, it's like we don't get the school buses like you do in America, so it's more of like a passenger bus, you know.
It's an Isuzu, but it's been used as a school bus here. So
it's about 10 meters long and 2.5 meters wide. And it's a good space to kit out and turn into what we think is the perfect home for ourselves. Yeah. So.
'Cause that's going to be our little off-grid haven, and we can park it up wherever we go. And maybe one day in the future, we'll find the perfect piece of land to park up the bus and create that permaculture garden that we've always dreamed of creating. But we're just not quite ready to make that commitment just yet. So this is one step towards that dream.
Very cool. I love tiny houses. I'm going to be looking forward to seeing your video about it on YouTube.
Yeah, we are going to continue to document our journey moving forward. So people who has followed our walk so far, or our journey so far, can continue doing that on our social channels if they want to.
Yeah, we'll segue right into the end here then. How can people find you online if they want to learn more?
We do have a website, as you mentioned before, rebootlife.me. But we're really more active on Facebook too. We have a Facebook page, reboot.life.me, or just search on Reboot Life on YouTube or Instagram. You should find us on there too.
But yeah, just type in Reboot Life, one word everywhere, and we should pop up.
Yeah, I think so. And we link to all our social channels on our website too. So check out rebootlife.me and you'll find us.
Karma and Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show, telling your story. Appreciate it. Best of luck with your tiny home adventures, tiny bus adventures. And hopefully you'll be able to get back on your trek here sometime in the near, not too far into the future anyway. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening. I'm now posting on Instagram, so be sure to follow me there. Just search for The Pursuit Zone. This episode was recorded on April 23rd, 2020. To send me an email, the address is paul@thepursuitzone.com, or you can leave me a voice message at speakpipe.com/thepursuitzone. The best way to support the podcast is to subscribe and share it with your friends. For the subscription links, show notes, and more, visit thepursuitzone.com.